This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe, Ian Aker, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show, and a busy show you will hear this morning. We're going to hear from Joellen Lapman of the New York State Integrated Pest Management Program on the Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley Show, from the Master Gardeners at Columbia Green Cornell Cooperative Extension. We are also going to hear from Assemblymember Sarah Hanna Shrestha about the recent New York State budget that passed in Albany. And we'll hear the WGXC Congressional Report with news from the past week of the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st Congressional Districts. And we'll hear national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. The stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network.
Hi, I'm Jack from Saugerties, and I'm at the radio station with my sister Katie. You're listening to WGXC Aqua. Have a nice day!
Brooklyn Vegan runs down the lineup for the 2023 edition of 24-Hour Drone, set for May 27th through 28th at Basilica Hudson in Hudson. The annual event has been on hold in person since 2019 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, the show is back in person with Yuka C. Honda of Saibo Matto, Wolf Eyes, Liturgy, Sarah Hines, Laura Ortman, and others performing at the event, which each year is webcast at WGXC.org and broadcast on 90.7 FM. The Basilica Hudson website has all the details about the 24-hour drone show May 27th and 28th at Basilica Hudson, and will air on WGXC.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of David White of Greenville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Aker, and you've tuned into the WGXC local news for Monday, May 15th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Mid-Hudson News reports that on May 10th, Hudson Link for Higher Education in Prison and Columbia Green Community College hosted their first commencement ceremony at the Green Haven Correctional Facility. 7 graduates earned their associate degrees in individual studies. Joel Jimenez, Hudson Link program director, said, quote, "Green Haven has always been close to my heart because I spent 8 years of my incarceration in that facility. I remember hoping to transfer to a facility like Sing Sing, where Hudson Link was operating a college program, one of the few in the state. When I became program director at Hudson Link, I set a goal to open a college program available to an entire population because I wanted the men at Greenhaven to have the opportunity I did not have when I was there. Education is one of the great equalizers as an incarcerated person could have, and so I am super excited to attend this graduation only 18 months since we opened the program, unquote. Jose Rodriguez was the Columbia Green Community College valedictorian at Greenhaven, and he said, quote, I want to say that I didn't do this just for me. I did this for all those that I've hurt by my past actions. I did this for my family, who continued to love me unconditionally and continue to be supportive. I did this for the man I called Dad, even though you're not here. I know you're still watching. I kept my promise. I told you I'd get this. And most importantly, I did this for my boys, my sons, who are my greatest achievement and greatest inspiration. I know I've let you down, but I'm picking up the pieces. Your poppy is making it happen, and it doesn't stop here, unquote. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. Kathleen Moore reports in the Times Union that Bethlehem school officials will ban cell phones for the entire school day starting in the fall, hoping it will lead to students socializing more often. Students won't even be able to use their phones at lunch or study times. Quote, this is when we want our students to be social and interact with one another, unquote, Superintendent Dave Hurst said at a school board meeting last week. Previously, teachers had asked students to put away their phones during class or put them in pouches hanging on a wall of the classroom. Hurst said that, quote, to some extent has curtailed phone use in the classrooms, but not entirely, unquote. Hurst cites studies showing a national increase in students feeling lonely and isolated, with higher depression and suicide rates. So the Bethlehem schools in Albany County will spend $26,773 on lockable bags that will be issued to every student this fall. Some parents are skeptical the plan will achieve the desired results. Quote, everyone's going to become a natural extrovert and talk to everyone in the cafeteria. The kids I know avoid the cafeteria, unquote, said parent Kara Brosu during a school board meeting. Quote, I wish they would socialize, but you can't just expect that to happen spontaneously by locking up their cell phone. There needs to be a path to get there, unquote. Students polled anonymously have differing views. One said it would take, quote, a weight off your shoulders, unquote, while another asked, quote, what am I going to do in my free periods? It would make my life suck, unquote. Two students questioned, worried about a lack of a phone during a school shooting. The Burnt Hills, Ballston Lake, and Green Island schools are also planning to ban phone use entirely. Psychiatrist Dr. Kevin Martin of Saratoga Springs isn't convinced that taking away the phones will work as intended. Quote, it's correlation, not necessarily causation. Around 2012, when we hit about 50% in smartphone usage, since then, even before the pandemic, mental health issues in kids and teens really went up, unquote, he said. Read more about this story in the Times Union. William J. Kemble reports in the Daily Freeman that the Lincoln Park DG LLC has notified Town of Ulster officials that they won't build a 20-megawatt electric generating plant off Frank Suttle Boulevard in Ulster County. The company left a phone message on May 12th without explaining why they were giving up on the plans. Supervisor James Quigley said, quote, we've had suspicions that there were issues with the project for several years. It goes back to December 2021 when they asked for a refund of all their escrow accounts. It didn't trigger anything at the time, but in retrospect, that's a tell, unquote. The project received site plan approval in 2019 after nearly 2 years of discussions and public controversy. The initial proposal for a 30,022-square-foot building shrunk to 40 smaller structures measuring 40 by 8 feet and set farther away from a residential neighborhood after community criticism. The company did clear about 3 acres of the 122-acre site, but did not begin construction. Quote, Central Hudson has indicated to me that the glide path engineer had stopped talking to them as it related to the design of the transmission line, unquote, Quigley said. Quote, NERSDA was unable to give me any status, so all these facts were coming in that indicated there was something astray here, unquote. The planning board approval required that unused land had to be preserved, so now developers are talking with Scenic Hudson about a public use of the property. Quote, it is a parcel that is very, very difficult to develop for anything. I can't even cut the trees and put solar up there because of the way the ridges are, unquote, Quigley said. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. And Jamal Cutler reports for Columbia Green Media that three candidates are running for two spots on the Germantown School Board on May 16th. David Riffenberg, Teresa Repko, and Cheryl Del Pazo Casluga are competing for the 2 4-year terms. Del Pazo Casluga works as a real property tax assessor for four municipalities within two counties and is a 1978 graduate of the Germantown schools. Repko has been on the board for 16 years. Riffenberg is a certified financial planner and a member of the Germantown Land Use and Zoning Update Committee, and used to lead the Germantown Youth Basketball Program and Southern Columbia Soccer League. The voting takes place from noon to 9 p.m. on May 16th at the school. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, May 15th. We are 36.9% of the way through the year, with 37 days left until summer. Local, early morning temperatures range from 30 degrees in Stephentown to 48 in Voorheesville. Regional, average soil temperature is 53 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be terrible. They are already registering at a 10 out of 12. It is expected to stay that way all week. A chilly start to the day turns comfortable with a high of 75 at 4 p.m. Overnight, temperatures dip to 48 degrees. Then, tomorrow, high of 80. And right around dark, a light chance of rain pops up. It then fades by midnight, and we see an overnight low of 45 degrees. That takes us into a dry Wednesday with a high of 60. Thursday, still dry, high of 66. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 12:03 a.m., low at 6:42 a.m., high again at 12:22 p.m., and low again at 7:02 p.m. The river temperature will be 62 degrees, and the tide strength will be high. Those conditions are centered around Hudson. If your position on the river is farther north, it will take longer for things to occur. And if you're farther south, it will happen sooner than I have stated. Just keep those in mind. Everything's relative. Just like the sunset, which will be at 8 o'clock p.m. due to the mountains obscuring it on its descent. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:34 a.m. Looking way up, we see a minor coronal mass ejection impact is expected tomorrow, with the angriest of sunspot groups rotating out of view. X-class flare chances for today are back down to 1%. Solar wind speed is currently 491 kilometers per second at 7.6 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair below 60 megahertz overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 109, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Next, we'll hear 2023 new music from jazz legend Kamisi Washington. This is from the limited series A Small Light. It's called Cheryl, from Kamisi Washington on WGXC. We'll be right back. Next, we're going to hear from the Master Gardeners at the Cornell Cooperative Extension. They have a podcast called Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. And each week on WGXC, we'll hear different segments from the show focused on local gardening and gardening for the time of year it is.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
And I'm Jean Thomas.
And welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley.
Today we're talking to Joellen Lampman of the New York State IPM program about ticks. Joellen, I don't even know where to start. Your job is a massive responsibility. And in your spare time, you're a turf grass expert for Cornell Cooperative Extension out of the Voorheesville office. It seems that you're on the road 8 days a week. You're training master gardeners one day, speaking to a garden club the next, writing blogs and starring in videos in between. Welcome, Joellen.
Oh, I am so very happy to be here. The job is broad and I am all over the place, but that's what makes it so incredibly exciting.
All right, let's start with your version of your life. Where did you go to school? How long have you been involved in IPM generally and ticks specifically?
So the life of Joellen, I'm one of those people that had to go a lot of different paths to get to where I am right now. But the one thing that really stayed with me my entire life was this love of nature and the environment and being able to share that and invoke that in other people. So I consider myself to be an environmental educator at heart. I grew up on Long Island. I escaped as soon as I possibly could. And I went to Cornell University, where I got a degree in natural resources. And from there, I actually tried to become a school teacher. Back then, it looked like there was the possibility of having environmental education in schools the way that we have art and music. And then that just didn't pan out. But I was able to use what I learned about being a teacher to be able to become a much better educator. So I have worked at residential environmental education centers, dragging kids through wetlands and different areas, which is always very exciting, especially when they're like, hey, my mom will get mad at me because I'm getting dirty. I spent a long time working for an environmental organization that worked directly with land managers to be more environmentally sensitive. And integrated pest management was part of the education that we did there. And IPM, for those in the know, is basically a process of looking at issues and coming up with a plan on how to deal with them. So after being with that organization for 17 years, I was looking for a change, and I had been involved with the New York State Integrated Pest Management Program on their coordinating council, and I mentioned to the person that led that I might be looking for something, and she was just like, well, it turns out that we have something opening up. So here I am. I joined the program in 2013, so I've been here for a while now, and I was hired specifically to work with schools and turf grass on their particular issues, but my life was pretty quickly taken over by the tick issue. It has just become much larger, and we were able to get funding from the New York State Senate Task Force for Lyme and other tick-borne diseases, which led us to being able to create the Don't Get Ticked New York campaign, which I've been heavily involved with since.
Oh, that's so cool. Don't get ticked, right?
It's in our resource list, so it'll be on the website.
It is. I need to pay attention.
www.don'tgetticked.ny.org.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so I'm going to go right there. So I've had many ticks on me, and we know that we need to avoid ticks. And there's this whole kind of relationship between ticks and deer and white-footed mice. Can you tell me how that works? And if there's a higher acorn population, we have more ticks the next year. How does that all work?
You know, it's funny. I mentioned that I am an environmental educator at heart, and I feel like wanting to help people make the connections between what we do and what happens out there has been such a big part of my life. And now that I'm working with integrated pest management on the icky stuff, you know, more about bed bugs than I ever wanted to know.
Oh my.
It's Lavender. So much easier to talk about our connections. So with ticks, it's very complicated. So yes, there's certainly this deer, mouse, tick connection and the acorns that you mentioned. So when we have years that are mast years where a lot of the oak trees coordinate with each other, which is a fascinating topic all in itself. And they release a mass of acorns. That means there's going to be a lot more food for the things that feed on it, like mice and deer and turkeys and lots of other things. So the year after the mass year, we're going to see a lot more of those potential hosts for the tick, which means that the next year we're going to have a very high tick population. Unfortunately, we don't see the numbers decrease after those tick populations.
Really?
The tick populations just keep going up and up. But because we don't have a mass year, the number of the mammals will start to go down. So now we have a lot of ticks with less wildlife out there for them to feed on. The ticks are out there waiting for something to pass by. So it's going to be a greater possibility for us or our companion animals to wander by rather than being picked up by a mouse or a deer first.
So I shouldn't feel good that last year was not a mass year for acorns. It doesn't really make a difference.
It was not a mass year.
I was going to feel good. No.
I'm sorry.
I know, because I had no acorns last year. So I'm thinking, oh, this year, fewer ticks. No.
There's basically nothing I'm going to tell you today that's going to make you feel good.
Oh, man. No. We need to have something at the end. We need to go out for ice cream or
something. I will
something.
Find something,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Tim becomes a taste treat.
I know. I know they're just waiting there, right? They're just waiting for you to walk
they're
by.
They're just waiting
right?
for you to walk by. And yes, last year was not a mass year for acorns,
right.
But the conifers went bananas. So that's also another food source that
can
helps
I
the mammal
that?
Pop. Yes.
The conifers went bananas, yeah.
Okay. You may already know this, Joellen, but our listeners may not be aware that Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners of Columbia and Greene Counties have been in combat against ticks for years. Our former Master Gardener Volunteer Coordinator Rick Burstell was passionate about the menace of ticks and worked tirelessly to learn more about them. It seems like Lyme disease was the catalyst for an entire industry of research and prevention of tick-borne diseases. Can you give us a brief chronology? Lyme disease was named in 1975, right? When did the other diseases and carriers start showing up?
So, yes, I've spoken to Rick about this many times.
No doubt.
He's definitely very, very passionate about it, as are many people that suffered from Lyme disease. It really is a debilitating disease. And if you caught it early on when the medical community didn't know what was going on.
Well, they were in denial.
Well, there was denial, and you still see some of that. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that was actually growing up on Long Island when I was a kid. It was all American dog ticks.
Yep.
And then as I reached teenagerhood, that was when we started hearing about Lyme disease and started really becoming concerned about the black-legged tick, also known as the deer tick and this Lyme disease. And as you said, we've been learning more about them, about the different diseases that they are carrying. So actually, before we knew about Lyme disease, we knew about Powassan virus, which is something I really want to talk about in a little bit. And then babesiosis, which is another disease that's really starting to expand in this area. Then we learned about Lyme disease, and then ehrlichiosis, and then anaplasmosis came after that. And then in around 2010, we got hit with Heartland virus, with Borrelia miyamotoi, Borrelia mayoni. We've got Heartland virus. We've got Bourvin virus. So we really started learning about a lot more of these diseases recently because we're looking for them, for one thing. When it comes to ticks and tick-borne diseases, we're really behind. Yeah, there was a catalyst in research starting around the 1970s, early 80s, but most of the research funding went towards mosquitoes. So we have a lot of catching up to do in regards to ticks. So for example, the Lone Star tick, which is a tick that is found throughout New York State, but we don't think it's breeding here yet in the Capital District. It will be at some point. It has a associated illness called southern tick associated rash illness, and we actually don't know if that's caused by a pathogen or if it's caused by a reaction to something that's within the tick saliva.
So all those diseases that you just spieled out, those are all deer tick diseases?
So not all of them.
Okay.
So some of them are, and most of them are, which is what makes the black-legged tick so very dangerous, because it can have so many diseases, and it can be transmitting more than one at a time.
And so if I would go to my doctor and said, oh, I had a tick on me, they would be looking, they would be testing for all these diseases generally?
It's going to really depend on your doctor. And this is a problem. So you really need to be an advocate for yourself. So if you go to our website, www.don'tgetticktny.org, you will see a section called Why Should I Worry About Ticks? And I actually have a chart on there that shows the different ticks that we find in this area along with the diseases that they are associated with. So once you get your tick properly identified, you can bring that chart to your doctor, because there are a lot of doctors that still don't know that it's more than Lyme disease, although anaplasmosis and babesiosis are becoming such an issue that they're more on medical personnel's radar than they used to be.
That was an excerpt of an interview from the Nature Calls Conversations from the Hudson Valley podcast from the master gardeners of the Cornell Cooperative Extension for Columbia and Greene Counties. You can hear the full episode at the Cornell Cooperative Extension webpage or at the WGXC archives at wgxc.org or at ccecolumbiagreene.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. For 31 states, the ERIC Voter Registration Change Database provides real election integrity, not the made-up kind. Now, it's under attack by conspiracy theorists. The Electronic Registration Information Center, commonly known as ERIC, is a nonpartisan, nonprofit cooperative of states which uses sophisticated computer matching to cross-reference voters who've moved, were duplicated, or have died. This helps keep voter rolls up to date and minimizes the chance that someone would vote in more than one place. Its governing board is made up of the state officials themselves. The nonprofit was founded in 2012 with a grant from the Pew Trust. In January, Alabama's incoming Secretary of State withdrew from ERIC, citing protection of its citizens' data. It was followed in March by Florida, Missouri, and West Virginia. Why? The Ohio State House News Bureau reports that a non-voting board member, formerly of Pew Trust, now works for Mark Zuckerberg's foundation, which provided grants to fund municipal election offices during the pandemic. The Associated Press writes that another conspiracy theory claims the original funding from Pew Trust for ERIC came in part from billionaire philanthropist George Soros. Secretaries of State pulling out of the program appear to be bowing to election denier activists and hurting, not improving, election security. We have articles and ERIC's FAQs at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. For the American Democracy Minute, I'm Brian Beal.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
If you would like to be on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM, now's your chance. Want to fulfill a long time or newly emerging desire to be on the radio? Want to become part of the community conversations on Wavefarms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears? You have an idea for a short recurring segment? Tune into a Zoom meeting May 30th at 6 p.m. online. Contact content at wgxc.org to register and with any questions. But we would love as many voices as possible to be on the radio at WGXC, and this is your chance. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and Philip Grant up in Rensselaer County and I are bringing you the WGXC Congressional Report, full of stories about what the candidates and representatives from the New York 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional districts have been up to this past week. Go to WGXC.org in the WGXC newsroom for complete coverage of your congressional representative.
New York State of Politics reports that the first of a potential wave of migrants arrived in the Hudson Valley on May 11th, after waves of migrants arrived in North America for the past several centuries. This time, though, they are being shipped around as political pawns from the southern border of the United States to New York City and then to the Hudson Valley. About 300 migrants are being bused to the Hudson Valley so far. Republican Representative Mark Molinaro says the area is not ready for them. Molinaro, the 19th Congressional District Representative, said, and I quote, "The concern is lack of coordination, a lack of transparency, a lack of infrastructure and support that exist in upstate counties," end quote. And while the Republican governors of Texas and Florida have been shipping the migrants around the country as political pawns, now the Democrat mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, is moving them to the Hudson Valley. Molinaro said that Adams has no authority to override state and local regulations to, and I quote, "impose," end quote, "the responsibility of caring for migrants." He said, and I quote, "it's not humane or compassionate," end quote. "It just isn't. The right approach is for the city and the state to confront that challenge in the city," end quote. On May 12th, pandemic-related asylum restrictions, known as Title 42, expired, with many migrants at the southern border of the United States waiting to enter the country, so there could be many more arrivals in the Hudson Valley in the weeks to come. Both Molinaro and Pat Ryan, a Democrat representing the 18th Congressional District, said the federal government should declare a state of emergency in New York because of the migrant arrivals. Ryan said, and I quote, "From New York City, where they have more than 60,000 asylum seekers, to the Hudson Valley communities, who were given no notice and no assistance to house asylum seekers, to the migrants themselves, simply here in search of a better life, this process has been a mess. The federal government must step in and declare a state of emergency for New York. This declaration would allow the federal government to identify, mobilize, and provide the resources necessary to alleviate the impacts of the migrant surge in New York. We will continue to work in close contact with our partners in local and state government to address the situation," end quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics.
House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik, who represents the 21st Congressional District in New York, stood next to Majority Leader Steve Scalise at a May 10th press conference to react to the news that Republican New York Representative George Santos was arrested and charged with wire fraud, money laundering, theft of funds, and lying to Congress. They said that Santos voluntarily stepped down from his committee assignments and that he has the presumption of innocence while the legal process plays out. Here is what Stefanik said at the press conference that was aired on C-SPAN.
As I've said from the very beginning on questions on this subject, this legal process is going to play itself out. Unfortunately, this is not the first time a member of Congress from either party has been indicted. There are a set of rules, and as the majority leader stated, he voluntarily had stepped down from his committees. We are committed to making sure that we root out any fraud when it comes to unemployment pandemic assistance, and we're working to have support from our conference, and it's good policy, and we urge the Democrats to vote in support of it.
Mari Thompson reports in the Glen Falls Post-Star that Jill Lochner, who is challenging Representative Elise Stefanik next year in the Republican primary, denounced Stefanik's vote on the debt limit bill that passed the House last week. Locally, Stefanik and Republican Mark Molinaro voted for the bill, while Democrats Paul Tonko and Pat Ryan voted against. Lochner complained that the legislation would cut Department of Veterans Affairs programs and that she would have insisted that the legislation include repealing a $10,000 limit of the federal income tax deduction for state income taxes. Quote, "The act is killing clean energy initiatives. It promotes coal and disincentivizes nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is America's workhorse," unquote, Lochner said. Quote, "If I were a member of Congress, I would be working with my party to get these changes made so that I'd be able to vote yes," unquote. Lochner said she now has a volunteer campaign coordinator in six of the 16 counties in the 21st Congressional District and held her first public forum this weekend in Canton. Read more about this story in the Glen Falls Post-Star. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that Democrat Pat Ryan and Republican Mark Molinaro are championing different ways to slow fentanyl trafficking at the country's southern border. Ryan has proposed an amendment to the current immigration bill to add $800 million for the Department of Homeland Security to lessen the fentanyl flow. Ryan's office released a statement that said, quote, "This includes funding for additional illicit drug inspection equipment, additional intelligence analysis, and canine units to increase the percentage of incoming passenger vehicles searched at the border, new operating labs at ports of entry to accelerate the identification of narcotics seized, and expanding a program to seize currency, weapons, and contraband that is flowing to transnational criminal organizations in Mexico," unquote. Democrat Ryan represents the 18th Congressional District. Republican Molinaro lives in that district but represents the 19th Congressional District. He said his vote this week for the Secure the Border Act of 2023 will combat drug trafficking and the opioid epidemic in New York. Quote, "The Secure the Border Act of 2023 will combat the opioid epidemic by strengthening efforts to curb the spike in fentanyl and drug trafficking along the border," unquote, Molinaro's office said in a statement. Quote, "It forces the Biden administration to restart the construction of the border wall, deploy an innovative technology to the southern and northern borders, and increase the number of Border Patrol agents," unquote. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. This has been the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Go to WGXC.org for more information.
Yeah.
If you are hungry or just want to help community radio, come on out on Thursday, May 25th to Left Bank Ciders in Catskill to their community soup night. WGXC is organizing this night, Thursday, May 25th, with a live on-site broadcast, DJs, and soup. Come on out for a bowl of soup, conversation, and some music. Each Thursday night, Left Bank Ciders hosts a community soup night where volunteers make soup with proceeds benefiting a local nonprofit. All proceeds go to Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM on Thursday, May 25th to Left Bank Ciders in Catskill from 5 to 7 p.m. Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
As the budget finally passed in New York, we are joined by Assemblymember Sarah Hanestressa to talk about that and what can get done in the last few weeks of session. Sarah Hanna, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Lots happened in the budget, so I'm trying to do my part explaining as much of it as possible.
It was a long overdue budget, but it finally passed. What was in it that you're happy about? Just maybe your overall reaction as a first term representative on this process and how it went from your point of view.
So the budget process in New York notoriously is very undemocratic. It favors the governor. A lot of it happens behind closed doors. But despite that, whatever we were given access to, I felt pretty satisfied with the effort we were able to put in to save a lot of funding and to also, you know, stop a lot of harm that could have gone into the budget. Because throughout this process that happens behind closed doors, you know, our Speaker of the Assembly also comes back to us with some of the things that are in play. And me and a lot of my other colleagues were really able to make a case for some of the things. And of course, you know, with Albany, it's like you never know what you say is going to have an impact. So you can't take a chance. You can't preemptively give in. So we really tried until the very last minute to speak against the bail reform rollback, to speak against some of the charter schools that are coming back, to speak for the Build Public Renewables Act, to speak for taxing the rich, to speak for higher minimum wage, especially for home care workers. So I feel overall pretty good as a first-term legislator with the effort that we were able to put in and with the collaborative nature of this effort. And the budget ended up being a very mixed bag. There were truly some very good things like Build Public Renewables, like all electric buildings, funding for public education. But, you know, it was rolled in with a lot of bad things. And the absence was notable as well, because there was a potential for really addressing some of the major crises that we are having right now. And we did some things for climate that are historic. But I think when it comes to housing, we really failed. So we are turning our attention in the few weeks that we have left to make sure that we get some tenant protections passed, like good cause eviction and like housing access vouchers program.
Great. That was an amazing overview. What is it in that process, like when you know to stop pushing, and how much time is left and what can really get done?
Not much time left. 4 weeks. You know, the session ends June 8th. And we have not even started talking about the possibility of extending the session. Many of us are in favor because the budget cut so much into that time, and because the budget didn't address many of the more, you know, urgent needs. On bail reform, we know for sure that if it wasn't for the legislature's pushback, this could have landed in a much worse place. We did have one win at the last minute, which was the discovery change. That was the piece that I was really concerned about. So we were happy that that was dropped. Discovery law pertains to the defense being able to ask for what they think is missing evidence and so on. And what the governor wanted was to have a time frame beyond which those requests could not be made, which is really pointless because it doesn't make sense, because if you realize that some evidence is being withheld, you should be able to ask for it, you know, as the defense. And all the folks involved wanted was actually just more money to be able to do the discovery part of the job better. And we were going to give them money, and we did give them money. And that was really going to be the solution. So there was no need to impose a time frame. And I think at the last minute, it got dropped because even the DAs were like, you know, we're not sure what this is really doing. And what it was going to result in was just a lot of people pleading guilty for no reason. You know, that was going to be sort of the effect of that. And on the bail side, you know, any change was going to be something that sends more people to pre-trial detention. And the biggest objection we have with how this went is that it was purely for a political purpose. And it did not work even as a political maneuver, because the right wing and the Republicans are already saying this is meaningless change. So from their perspective, it's a meaningless change. From our perspective, it is a change that's substantial enough that it's going to send more people to pretrial detention. So it's really unfortunate. And that's why, you know, some of us voted no on the bill that had this change. And that was the quote unquote big ugly bill that had all of the contentious items. And so I had to vote against the bill that had Bill Public Renewables, that had all electric, because it also had bail reform rollback, and the bail reform rollback change was dead on arrival. We were never going to vote yes on it, and we just had to stick through with it. And we also knew, though, that a lot of people had fought for Bill Public Renewables for years, you know, 4 years to be exact, and likewise for all electric, that voting yes on it was not the win that we needed. We had basically won, because it was in this bill, and this budget was sure to pass. You know, it's not like our votes were going to affect the passage of the budget. So it was important to take a meaningful stand against it. You know, we don't want the governor to think that the legislature did not have reservations about this budget.
Wow, it is complicated. So in the end, what happened with Build Public Renewables, and what should we know as the public about the Build Public Renewable Act?
The reason I ran for office was to pass this bill. So I'm pretty thrilled, first of all, that it got done within effectively the first 4 months of my term. That's pretty exciting. But really, there was so much organizing that went into this bill in the last 4 years. And the full bill that we did not pass is a very thoughtful and transformative bill, because it is not just talking about climate change. It's talking about, you know, who should own our energy system. And this really opens up the pathway for more nonprofit and publicly owned players to have a seat, because the private market is, of course, terrified of public power entities having a role, because they think it's unfair. And precisely for the reason that we think it's necessary, which is that public power entities are much better at, you know, being able to do things like building renewable energy, which they were not really allowed to do beyond a very limiting cap. Even though we did not get the full bill text, we got substantial things that we are happy enough with to claim this as a win. First, New York Power Authority is going to be authorized and directed to build the amount of renewable energy that is our shortcoming in each period. If there's a shortage coming from the private market, NYPA is going to be instructed to build to make for this gap. So this will really put us on track to meet our goals. Second, we got the labor language that we wanted, because we absolutely want to change the landscape of how labor interacts with renewable energy. Right now, it's pretty bad. There's hardly any protections. Renewables is not a strong union market for workers. And right now, even the more conservative unions are celebrating this bill, especially the labor language. So that's a great start. And then we have critical timelines, like, you know, phasing out the fossil fuel peaker plants by 2030. I am already hearing that NYPA is getting started proactively looking into land that it owns so that it could start doing renewable energy. And I'm also excited about the prospects for this bill being a model for other states. And that's something that we are very invested in helping to move along, because, like I said, this is not a bill that is within the private market domain. It's really shifting the power dynamics into energy democracy and public power. And that's what's so radical and transformative about what we want in this budget.
awesome assembly member. We're actually quickly running out of time, but there's one major thing that you brought up, which is spending this time that you have left on some housing legislation. And I was wondering where that was going.
Yeah, and I want to invite you and all of your listeners also to a call, a mass call we're doing on Zoom on May 17th at 7 p.m. You can register bit.ly/sarahana-budget. And we're going to be talking a more deeper overview of the budget process, what happened, and what we're going to do in the next remaining weeks. The corporate real estate industry is very strongly against good cause evictions. And it is from a very capitalist position that it's nobody's business to tell landlords what they can charge because it's their private property. But this is not, we're not talking about one or two landlords, right? This is a crisis happening all over the state where people simply cannot afford to live here anymore. And it needs immediate attention. So the leaders of the legislatures know that this is a top priority issue for their members. What we really want to emphasize is that this is a top priority for this session and not next year, because the conversation from the governor is already next year, and we want to make sure that we have something substantial before we leave this session. So we're going to have action in Albany on May 31st. We're having some local action here in Kingston, and there might be other local actions all over the state. So we want to let everybody know how they can tap in, because it's really an all hands on deck situation at this point because of the limited time that we have.
Sarahana, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your knowledge and your work with us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Thank you.